You're listening to the 100th episode of a podcast of Spurious Morality. Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. I'm Johnston and today I'm joined by a nice big group of Spodcasters and we're all going to sort of discuss how we got into Doctor Who. It is our 100th episode. We have done 100 of these now, which feels fantastic. It's such a milestone to get to. Quite exciting, and obviously we've had many, many people listen to us over the last couple of years. We are going to go off on a little bit of a end of season break soon and return with a third series in the summer. But we've got one more episode after this one, but we had to mark 100. There was no way we couldn't mark 100. So to start off, with me, I have Mansour.
Hello.
I have Mark.
Hello.
And I have Connor.
Hello.
So yes, it's great to have you all here. We're doing it in sort of turns, so it doesn't all get a bit too busy. But for our 100th episode, we are coming together to talk about how we first discovered Doctor Who, or how Doctor Who first discovered us, I guess, depending on how it occurred. So we're all going to talk about that, and I need to pick on somebody. So it's Connor. I'm picking on Connor. Connor, you can go first. I know.
Thank you.
You're so surprised, aren't you?
It was only ever going one way.
So go on. How did you get into Doctor Who?
I got into Doctor Who by way of my uncle. We were away on holiday together, all my family, and about an hour before Rose started, my uncle said to my family, Doctor Who's back tonight, we should all watch that. So I had no idea what it was, and I quizzed him in that hour. I made best use of my time and quizzed him on everything he could tell me about this amazing program that I'd never ever heard of or seen before. And he told me about the Daleks and that there were lots of different Doctors and all of that sort of thing. So I got a crash course in the history of Doctor Who just before Rose started. So I went into this not entirely blind, but I remember being very disappointed that the Daleks didn't turn up in the very first episode, because it had been drummed into me very quickly that the Daleks were the best villains ever. It's as simple as that. I think that's a very common way in a lot of people. My sort of generation and my age group started watching Doctor Who in that exact same way with Rose in 2005. And it definitely was a case of falling in love immediately. I remember sitting in total awe of the title sequence and the theme and the TARDIS flying through these, this whirling maelstrom of the vortex, and just being hooked from the word go, and being like Christopher Eccleston, I had never heard of before he went. He was my absolute hero overnight. It really was just a case of love at first sight. And it feels like I was straight in there, like, I love this thing and this will become my whole life now. And it quite literally did. I still feel the exact same love for it now as I did in 2005. as time sort of went on, I stayed hooked. Like, it is still appointment viewing. Every time it's on, I will sit, like, I will be there on the sofa waiting for it at least 10 minutes before it starts. I'm trying to think when I got into Big Finish as well, because that was another big step. That's a slightly more convoluted story than it probably could have been, or maybe slightly more convoluted than it needs to be, because there were sort of two starts. I remember getting the Veiled Leopard back in 2005 or 2006. It just came a little slipcase CD with Doctor Who magazine. And being amazed that there was this version of Doctor Who that I could listen to on my CD player. Even though it doesn't have any Doctors in it, and the only thing that you can possibly recognise, like the theme was different, the characters were all different, the only thing I recognised, I remember, was the sound of the sonic screwdriver, because it was identical. And even despite that, I listened to that hundreds of times over the years, and I was delighted to hear the adventures of Ace and Tex and Perry and Aramem at 8 years old. And then I got my second start in 2015 because they took Doctor Who off the air for a year, 2015, 2016. And as soon as they announced that there was going to be no series of Doctor Who on TV in 2016, I was like, right, I'm going to get into Big Finish and Paul McGann will be my Doctor for 2016. I got 2 CD sets for Christmas that year, 2015. It was Damaged Goods and Doom Coalition, which were a pretty damn good introduction for a new series fan who had absolutely no idea about the classic series or any of its characters at the time. So that's a very, very quick crash course introduction to my history of Doctor Who. And I'm going to hand over to someone else now because I think I've just waffled enough there.
It must be a great place to start, Rose, because it's literally designed to be a place to start, and it did introduce a whole new generation to it. So it must be pretty great to be kind of on that tidal wave, really. Like, a lot of people have very, very similar stories, I guess.
Well, the thing is, it worked. It worked. I think, you know, I was 7 or 8 years old at the time. I think I was the exact target audience for Rose. And even if I go back and watch it now, I don't think it works so well for someone who is a fan of Doctor Who. Certainly for someone who is a fan of the new series, because it's all very straightforward stuff now looking back. But I understand that at the time it had to do 2 equally important things. It had to hook me as someone who didn't know anything about Doctor Who and people like me. Kids, you know, who they obviously wanted this, you know, to be the new generation of to appeal to this new generation. But it also had to go back and hook people from the classic series as well. And I think probably reassure them that this is the same program, but it's going to be like this now, if that makes sense. Like, you have to reintroduce an old program and transform it at the same time. I think it does that really well. Because the TARDIS is identical, it's still a police box, the sonic screwdriver sounds the same, the autons are in it, you know, and yet everything's so different. The Doctor's very different, it's a new type of companion. The TARDIS has never looked like it did before, you know. It's an episode that is many different things and does many different things and somehow manages to do them all very well. It's a great start.
And I think that using the autons was just like a stroke of genius. Sort of the implication there is, well, it's just like Spearhead from Space, which was launching a brave new era. It was a relaunch of Doctor Who. So it kind of, you know, even to a fan, it would evoke that. And yeah, it was a brilliant move. And, you know, they're a pretty cool monster as well. Let's pick on somebody else then. Mark, do you want to go? Tell us how you first discovered Doctor Who.
Oh, well, I am unquestionably your most elderly contributor. I think in the entire history of this thing, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm almost certain that that's the case, sadly. So I was born in 1977, and my earliest memory of being alive, this is similar to Russell T. Davis, the way he says his first memory of life is actually watching Doctor Who. I have exactly the same thing. In my case, it's part 4 of Megalos. Make of that what you will. But Yeah, so I have just the tiniest vague memory of Tom Baker, just in my earliest years, and then Peter Davison went on to become my real formative childhood doctor, and I just grew to love the show and became more and more just like appointment viewing. This cannot be missed. You know, this show is sacred to me, and more so as the 80s went on, and then all of a sudden 1989 comes along. I'm 12 years old at that point, and I'm watching season 26 quite unaware of you know, I watched the end of Survival, and I consciously pick up on something of a melancholy tone to the ending, but there was nothing overtly to say like this will not be back. And then, you know, went through the next few months, waited for the usual autumn trailer to come round for Doctor Who, not a sign of it. And it was a really interesting age for that to happen to me, because it's the point at which I think ordinarily one, if you're not going to be a fan, you sort of step off the train at that point, you know, the teenage years. Whereas because I was absolutely mystified at the non-return of this show, I went looking for answers, and I discovered the existence of Doctor Who magazine. And I got my first issue of Doctor Who magazine in November of 1990, issue 168. And there's been an unbroken chain of month to month ever since with that. But I went delving deep and trying to find answers as to why the show wasn't back. And in the process of doing so, obviously found out that, depressingly, there were just no answers coming from the BBC on that. They were being very cleverly evasive, having learned the mistakes in inverted commas of 85 in terms of being upfront about things. With the hiatus and whatnot. So two things began to happen simultaneously. Obviously, I was on the lookout for the possible return of the show. And the other was that like a lot of fans at that point, I was just ingesting a lot of the show's past, because with no future track being laid, there was let's look backwards and let's reappraise and so on. So the 90s was a really interesting point to become a card-carrying fan, because it really was that the years where a lot of sacred cows were being slaughtered in fanzines and all sorts of things. And then I was just, as I say, getting into all the reference books, Doctor Who magazine. I joined the Appreciation Society for a good long time, and just lived and breathed Doctor Who for an unhealthily disproportionate percentage of my life, I guess, compared to non-fans, you know, the casual viewer. And I remember just by the mid-90s, nobody in school they only had the vaguest memories of what Doctor Who even was, and they were astonished that I was into this thing, you know. But I remember making a sort of an internal promise to myself that I would never abandon the thing. And then the new adventures came along, and it basically became the show. I think it was crucially two things for me that really cemented, like, okay, I'm a fan for life now. Because it was like the show continuing, albeit in book form. This was the official canonical continuation, as they said at the time. But it also allowed the show to grow up a little with an aging fan readership. And so it was kind of pushing new boundaries, and exactly the way Connor was talking about with what the new series came in, you know, came in and sort of adjusted the formula a bit, but was still very recognizably Doctor Who at its heart. And then, like Connor, Big Finish, you know, that became a big major strand as well of my fandom. And another crucial one for me that ties into what we're doing right now was when I began to listen to podcasts. I turned 30 in October of 2007, and I was given an iPod for my 30th birthday, and within 24 hours I had discovered the existence of A, podcasts, and B, more importantly, Doctor Who podcasts. And there were only really two big ones around at the time with any staying power. One of them was a thing called Podchalk, which is long since gone. And the other one, which survives to this day, was Radio Free Scarrow, which remains a favorite. But I, never in my wildest dreams, listening to all these podcasts between then and now, and goodness knows how many countless hours of podcasting I've listened to, Doctor Who related and otherwise. I never once thought I'd get a chance to contribute. And people talk about how Doctor Who is a great crucible for bringing out creativity in people, in fans. And I've never really, to be honest, been somebody who's had an opportunity to do much in the way of kind of, as it were, like giving something back, other than sort of talking on the online forums and so on. But to do something like this, which I guess falls into the realm of creative to some extent, I'm so grateful for it. And I'm so grateful to be, yeah, to have been invited on to here. Because Johnson, I know you set the podcast up. I know you do all the heavy lifting from the outset in terms of editing and so on. Connor, I know you've done a lot of that too. And I'm just really grateful to even be lightly involved in on an occasional basis. I will shut up now because I feel like I've been talking for way too long and hand over to somebody else.
I guess that's the power of it all, really, isn't it? Like, it does bring people together, and there's so much of it that it's... I think Doctor Who's an amazing discussion point because there are so many different eras, doctors, companions, stories, takes on it, mediums to enjoy it through that you can kind of relate to. So yeah, it's a fantastic way of making friends because you've already got this absolutely enormous library of potential conversation. And I guess podcasting, I guess what we do, the way we do it in particular, is a really nice extension of that.
I think Doctor Who is the single most flexible format of any program or series or like franchise, I guess, of any, because like it can be and is frequently, you know, anything. I'm thinking like series 7 of the new series in particular, where they did like it's a thriller one week, it's a western the next, and it's historical. You know, it's the only series and show, and it's the only property, I guess, that is that flexibility is inherently built into, and I think that's what draws a lot of the creativity and people both involved in the show and who are fans of it out.
And if I might just jump in on one further point I had meant to say there, Doctor Who sits at the epicenter of everything for me, but I'm so grateful to it for having led me ever outwards in increasing circles, outwards into other realms like Blake 7 and archive BBC TV in general, and the whole history of how TV's, anyway, all these old cult TV, Sapphire and Steel, all these wonderful things that I would never have got to if it were not for Doctor Who. I'd just be sitting watching, I don't know, whatever everybody else watches, EastEnders and Breaking Bad or something, and I'm much happier delving into all this wonderful stuff from the archives that half the people out there don't even know about, sadly, but I've no regrets.
I've often seen it referred to as a gateway drug to archive TV, and it's so true.
That's exactly it, yeah.
It really is. All right, well, we'll shift along. We'll shift along to Mansour. Tell us your story.
So I think I'm not quite sure of the exact sequence, but I think the first time I really was introduced to Doctor Who was the Target novelizations. I think I remember being at school and we had a bit in the school library where you could actually buy new books. They had a few for sale, and they had, I think they had like a whole display of Doctor Who Target novelizations. And yeah, I remember reading and rereading lots of those, and there were stories that were some of my favourites to reread. And I guess with like a lot of things, like when you discover that there's a wider fandom and received ideas about different things, but like stories like Mind Robber or Celestial Toymaker or Dalek's Master Plan or The Chase, they seem to me like really exciting and interesting stories. And then I later discovered that not everyone shares that view, but yeah, there's something about coming into it via the Target novelizations, which sometimes were just transcriptions of the scripts, but often went a little bit beyond, especially towards the end of the range. But even early on, there were stories like The Ark in Space, where the visual descriptions were the original concepts before budgets and shooting schedules and things scaled back the ambition of what they were trying to achieve. Although I think the Ark in Space still looks really impressive on screen, some of the sets. So yeah, it was all just my imagination, and there was nothing restricting things in terms of budget or special effects, which probably helped my impression of some of those more divisive stories. For actual TV Doctor Who, again, I'm not quite sure of the sequence, but I think, I have memories of Colin Baker being on Blue Peter, so I think it would have been around Trial of a Time Lord, but the only, probably like before Trial of a Time Lord started, but the only sort of concrete memory I can think of watching Trial of a Time Lord is that cliffhanger when he's being sucked into the sand. And being quite young at the time, that was quite a sort of compelling, scary cliffhanger to be left on. The first like full story I watched, again, I'm not sure whether it was before I saw Trial of a Time Lord or after, but I got The Ark in Space for my birthday, I think, on VHS, and then I watched most of the McCoy era. Like, my memory of season 24 might be a bit more patchy, but I think I saw most of it, and then I think I saw pretty much every single season 25 and 26 episode. There was one episode of Remembrance of the Daleks that I missed because I was away from home that week. And then, yeah, tuned in the week after Survival finished, because I didn't even know that was the end of the season. And I don't know what program it was, but there were some people loading some equipment onto a van, and it clearly wasn't Doctor Who. So, and then, yeah, later down the line, I discovered that that was the end of the show. But I was then very, very into the New Adventures, to the point where the version of the Seventh Doctor in the New Adventures, that feels like the Seventh Doctor, that's the sort of core version of the Seventh Doctor that I've got in my head. So it kind of came full circle from starting with Target novelizations and then the New Adventures really being the era where the concepts of what Doctor Who is and what it can be and who the Doctor is got cemented in my mind. So that's why, like, I've mentioned the books quite a lot on this podcast. Like, it always interests me and excites me when the new series circles back and starts dipping into concepts or ideas or territories that the New Adventures explored. Not, you know, being just adult in the sense of being violent or swearing like some of the early books were doing, but just being adult in the sense of having more deeply fleshed out characterization, treating the companions as much more rounded characters and point of view characters, rather than just, not saying this is the case throughout all of classic Doctor Who, but making sure that it kept them foregrounded as three-dimensional characters. And sometimes there were stories where the Doctor was even quite absent for a lot of it, and Ace or Bernice or Chris or Roz were leading things. So yeah, I think that's a bit of a run through of my introduction through various media. I didn't really engage with much of the comics. I dipped into some of those here and there, but that was more later. And then obviously was very excited and then disappointed with the TV movie arriving and then not turning into anything. And then very excited when Big Finish started up a few years after that.
I think it's, I wasn't really there sort of at the time when Big Finish started. You know, I'd discovered Doctor Who by then, but at that point I was 7 years old. And I think it's probably difficult to imagine just how momentous that was when it first came about. You know, here's a set of new Doctor Who stories on audio with all the original cast in. It must have been absolutely exceptional to just have that at a time.
It was a big thing, but I was so attached to the new adventures that I think I saw them as the primary continuation of Doctor Who. And when Big Finish started, we didn't even know that Paul McGann was going to be around. So right from the offset, from those first initial stories, it was a backwards-looking range. It was going back and filling in gaps rather than forging a new direction forward. That did change quite quickly when Paul McGann arrived and you did have the continuation of Doctor Who on audio. So I think I was excited, I was really interested, and the Bernice stories were really strong that they did before the Doctor Who ones. But at the same time, there was something, if we get into personal ideas of canon, I would have seen the new adventures as more, bizarrely, like more canon, even though there's no actual actors performing those words and those stories. Things obviously did change and Big Finish developed and grew quite rapidly.
I feel as though we've got our 200th episode set up there. What's your idea of canon? And we've got 100 episodes to think about it.
Just to remind you all that the only thing the BBC have ever said is canon is the adventure games. So I guess the adventure games and Class are the only two things that the BBC have definitely said this is canon.
Who said Class was canon?
Something in that original announcement. This is new Doctor Who spin-off. It's all canon. No.
What I was just going to say there before was in terms of my own, this is quite a sort of a Northern Ireland thing. I was essentially cut off from the whole convention landscape because basically people didn't really come here. But there were two conventions in the 1990s that just sort of suddenly popped up out of nowhere, 1998 and 1999, I think. And they were in a little town called Bangor. We have a Bangor as well. It's smaller than the one in Wales, I imagine. And there were these two little Panopticon, sort of mirroring the Panopticon ones of the time, conventions that popped up. And just being able to go along to very nervously to a couple of those. And I was and remain a very socially anxious person, so I almost bottled it. But I went along, and I got to meet Annika Wills, Michael Kreis, Deborah Watling, and Sylvester McCoy at these, and it was absolutely mind blowing. You know, I was so nervous, but there was something like, I don't know, there may have been fewer than 100 people in that hall, and when you look at the rediscovery now since the revival of these old characters and how popular they are with people who weren't even born at the time I went along to these conventions, I don't know if I'd have if my nerves would be up to going to one of these larger events now, but I'm so glad I had that experience to just go to one or two, and at a time when I guess the actors concerned were almost entirely forgotten, and there was just a very small faithful few carrying the flame, and it was nice to be part of that. And the other thing I just wanted to say quickly was, Mansoor, you brought up the business of libraries and so on, and that I feel terrible for having left that strand out of my childhood, because that was so important to me as well. The Target novelizations and discovering old stories through those, and I've still really strong memories, vivid memories of reading things like Image of the Fendal, staying up way past my bedtime to finish those books and getting a really vivid impression, because there was no concept that they'd ever be out on VHS or anything else at that point. So for those stories to live again in print was just incredible. Anyway, that's probably covered.
I read a lot as well, both like buying Targets and from the library as well, I think. And we had this log in our class where you're meant to log all the books that you're reading, just books in general. And my list in that book was all just like Doctor Who and the, because it was all the just the targets, basically.
And there was Junior Doctor Who and the Giant Robot, which blew my mind as a child, looking at it in the library and thinking, what on earth does that mean? Like, Junior Doctor Who? But it was just a very stripped back version of the original, like an even more simplified version of the original Terence Dix novelization, I think, if it was Terence Dix. I can't remember. I've probably got that appallingly wrong, but anyway, you get the idea. Yeah, but I have, yeah, I can remember exactly where I was and what I was doing when I read certain books, like, or certain novelizations. I remember reading State of Decay on our first or second foreign holiday as a family and stuff like that, and those memories never leave you, because you there's always a little bit of Doctor Who would have traveled with me everywhere. If you weren't going on holiday, it's like, no, I can't be without a little bit of Doctor Who, you know. So I guess I just had to keep feeding my habit through some medium or other, no matter where we were.
I love that Doctor Who has pretty much since the 70s always had some form or other of like book or novel representation. And I don't know that, maybe aside from Star Wars, I don't think anything else has had that between the Targets and the New Adventures and the Past Doctor and the BBC books and that sort of thing.
So Star Trek's had quite a substantial, like there's hundreds of Star Trek
novels. Yeah. I just remember similar sorts of stories just from slightly later on in time, going into like Waterstones and finding, I can't remember if this is a figment of my imagination, not, but I remember if you walk into any Waterstones today, there will be at least one bay of books devoted entirely to Harry Potter. I vaguely remember going into Waterstones when I was little and seeing a Doctor Who bay, and like it had been done out with a proper header and all. And being able, like, it was the new series adventures, the stuff, I still remember that first wave of like the Deviant Strain and the Monsters Inside. Devoured those books, still have a whole collection of them here, and if I'm ever in a secondhand bookshop and see one I don't have, I will buy it. But I love that Doctor Who has this rich, I don't want to say literary, because it's not literary, it's good old pulpy fun, but there's this printed sort of, this wealth of printed Doctor Who as well as what we've had on screen and on audio, and I love that very much. I think, judging by what has been listed on Amazon, there's more. I think for the first time they're going to do like original novels that go out alongside the series, by the looks of it. I'm hoping that's what, you know, is going to happen. I think it'll be the first time they've done that since 2017, 2018. I just love that whole side of Doctor Who, that you can walk into a bookshop and pick up a Doctor Who novel that, you know, it's not necessarily something you've seen on screen. And even if it is in the case of the Target novels, it's great. You have a Doctor Who novel to take and read at your lunchtime or on the bus or on a plane or something like that.
And it'd be good to have more fiction focus as well, because I'm sure a lot of them are great, but it feels like in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, there's been this explosion in the kind of reference books, like the large format books. And I'm sure some of them are good, but they all seem to blend together to me, like all these, glossy or coffee table books, and the actual stories seem to have died down.
I was just going to say, talking about those sort of large coffee table style books, there was a splurge of those in the 90s as well. I remember that very well. Things like there would be a book dedicated to just the 60s, just the 70s, just the 90s. I think it was those House, Dammers and Walkers ones, and then things like the Discontinuity Guide would come out. And
I still have my great big Doctor Who, The Legacy Continues book. That's where I get all of, I've had a lot of the Doctors and Companions sign it. They all get a big full page photograph when they arrive in, and that's where I've got all my autographs, is one of those great big coffee table books, and I love it to bits.
Awesome.
Oh, fantastic.
I think my first ever one was 25 Glorious Years by Peter Haining. A man I don't think necessarily known for his total accuracy in terms of what he wrote, but he was still a bit of a path forger as far as, you know, creating a niche in the marketplace for those sorts of big reference tomes about Doctor Who. And then, of course, with each successive generation of writers, you get the rare, you know, by the time you get to, I don't know, somebody like Simon is it Simon Guerrier that writes the really deep dives into people like David Whittaker and so on. You're into some really hardcore, you know, deep level stuff. But
it was relatively slim. But I had the JNT one that I think by the time I got it, Sylvester McCoy was already around, but it only went up to Colin Baker. And it was, I think, written by JNT, just his recollections of each era.
Okay. Well, thank you very, very much, all of you guys, for sharing all of that. It's great to know that we've all kind of got into it in different ways. So I will now, release you from the virtual Spodcast recording studio, and I will join somebody else. And I'm now joined by Jimmy. Hello, Jimmy.
Hey.
So, continuing our 100th Spodcast episode celebration, tell us the story of how you first got into Doctor Who. I imagine yours is sort of kind of different to most of the people's, purely due to geography.
Yeah, well, I discovered it when I was about 9 years old. So I was in primary school, and this would have been during the gap between the classic series finishing and the TV movie bringing it back for its last hurrah. So it was, as I say, I was about 9 years old, and I was at a friend's house, and her mum had called her out to the backyard to help bringing in the washing, and so I was bored doing nothing, and I was just walking around, and I walked past the lounge room, and her dad was watching these cool sci-fi robots fighting each other, and I was like, oh, what's that? And he was like, oh, it's Doctor Who. And so then my friend came back in, and she was like, ready to play with me again or whatever, and I'm just like, yeah, just a minute, watching through the door, watching the five doctors. And I obviously eventually stopped and went back to her, but I got home and I'm like, oh, Mum, I discovered the coolest show, it's called Doctor Who. And she's like, oh, your dad loved that back when we were first dating. And so I just discovered it from there, and it was, of course, it wasn't on TV at the time, it was as I say, after the classic series, the main bulk of it had finished. And so there were, however, the videos were out. And so I occasionally would borrow them from the local video shop. And I got lucky at one stage. And since they weren't many people renting them, they were like, oh, I'll give you these 10 for like $5 or something. So I got a bunch of stories, and that helped me really get into it. So I can't actually remember. I know the first story I saw was, as I said, walking in halfway through the five doctors and seeing the Cybermen and the Rastorn warrior robot fight. But after that, I can remember the next several or so stories, but I can't remember the order I watched them in. But it was something like a combination of the three doctors, Vengeance on Varos, what else? The Time Warrior, and The Invasion of Time. So those were some of the first few. And then, of course, I was instantly a fan, and my friends all knew it. And in my 10th birthday, they gave me this Doctor Who diary thing. And it just happened to be, of course, that would be the next year, 1996. And the one time I actually wrote in the diary was about the TV movie coming out and how excited I was. And so that's how I got into it. And then, of course, in 2003, the ABC repeated all that they could of the classic series in order, which basically was most of the surviving episodes, except for like stories that partially survived and partially missing. They just skipped those entirely. And they also skipped a few other Dalek stories because of copyright. So I was lucky. I'd discovered the internet forums and that, and I'd learned a bit about the show. And so I knew why there were these weird gaps, but I can't imagine what it would have been like if someone going, oh, yeah, I've been watching the Hartnell era, you know, the first two seasons, I've only missed three stories, so everything up to the time Medler feels basically natural, and then suddenly you jumped forward to the arc and Vicky's gone and Dodo's there. But I imagine it's even worse for the end of the Hartnell era and the start of the Troughton, because, of course, you jump straight from the War Machines to the Tomb of the Cybermen. So I imagine that was a shock for anyone who didn't know what was going on.
I've sort of lamented this with Greg on this podcast in the past, that in the UK, Doctor Who has been rebroadcast very, very little. So it was very, very rare to kind of catch it on TV. Like, I remember the first time I saw, I'm pretty sure it was Genesis of the Daleks, was It was about 99 and it was a rerun on BBC Two. And I think I was the only person that watched it because everybody else didn't or had it on video already by that point or whatever. But they canned this kind of repeat season. Oh. I think the original idea, it was going to be, they were starting at Spearhead and they were going to basically do everything that was in colour. They did Spearhead, they did Silurians, and then they jumped forward to Genesis, and then they scrapped it after Genesis. So it really didn't last particularly long.
Yeah, we got pretty lucky here with that 2003 repeat series starting, because, yeah, I mean, otherwise it would have taken a lot longer to get into the show and picking up bits and pieces here and there, but that and the DVDs just came at the right time for me.
Yeah, it was... a lot of stuff wasn't really accessible to me until it was around the time the DVDs started coming out, and all of a sudden all of the VHS, the video shops were just like determined to get rid of the stock. So all of a sudden Doctor Who videos became like £3 a go. They became really, really cheap. Nice. So I was probably about 10 at that point. But it took quite a long time to get there. So yeah, it was quite a weird phenomenon to kind of, I guess it's have those floodgates open all of a sudden. So yeah, like that repeat season must have been a kind of similar phenomenon. Like all of a sudden, everything's there, everything's accessible or near enough.
Yeah, well, they powered through it pretty quick because it was on it started at 5 nights a week, but after a while they dropped the Fridays and so it was 4 nights a week. But yeah, going at that pace, and especially with the missing episodes and the partially missing stories skipped and a lot of the Daleks stories skipped, I think it only took about, 3 or 4 years before it had got all the way to survival and finished. And, of course, that was around the time that the new series had actually started. So that was pretty cool because 2005, that's the other story I've got, was my first convention and it was they did this tour of Australia and every state they had Sylvester McCoy, Colin Baker and Katie Manning, and it was just so awesome to meet them, and I would have loved to meet them again someday. I did meet Colin again, but Sylv was supposed to be at that convention, but he had to drop out because they rescheduled Hobbit filming and moved it a couple of weeks earlier.
Pesky Hobbit films.
Yep.
It was a running joke in Five-ish Doctors
yeah,
as well, wasn't it?
I was in
it?
The Hobbit show.
Yeah. I bet he's only on telly, but it's not a motion picture.
Yeah,
that was fantastic. but yeah, that's absolutely brilliant. And it's kind of great to just kind of, it's kind of similar to my story, that is, just that it was kind of on in the background when I was somewhere and I suddenly had this, ooh, what's this kind of moment.
Yeah.
But I'm saving that for later in this episode. So there we go.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear everyone else's stories because we've recorded this bit separately, of course, and I'm, yeah, looking forward to hearing everyone else, how they got into it.
Yes, this is the first podcast episode in well over a year that's had multiple recording sessions. So it's quite interesting to do, and it's great to catch up with everybody as well because, like, it's been a while since we've done a season by season at this point. We record those well in advance and we've had a bit of a recording break. So it's good to have a catch up. So thank you so much for joining me, Jimmy. And yeah, here's to more podcasting together. Thank you.
Excellent. My pleasure. Looking forward to it.
And for the final segment of this, our 100th episode, I am joined by yet more podcasters. So I'm going to say hello to Greg.
Hello.
And hello to Gareth.
Afternoon.
So last but definitely not least. So yes, we've all been sharing our how did we discover Doctor Who stories. And I think it's probably time I told mine. Which compared to some of the ones we've had, this one's like fairly boring to be honest. But I was one of those sort of weird 90s babies. So there was no Doctor Who on TV at all as I was growing up. No new Doctor Who at any rate. And therefore, it's not like it was just something that was on Saturday night that I could catch or anything like that. I think the first time Doctor Who was broadcast on the BBC in my lifetime was it 99? I think they started to repeat season and they did Spearhead and Silurians and then decided that nobody was watching Pertwee, so gave us Genesis of the Daleks instead to see if that kick-started a bit of an audience share, and it didn't, and that was that. That was the big, ambitious, we're going to show every colour episode repeat season. It ended up being three serials. But one day I was left with my uncle, and he stuck the telly on. It was a Sunday morning, I believe, or Saturday morning, one or the other. He stuck the telly on, and on the TV was UK Gold, and UK Gold that day was showing Attack of the Cybermen. So I think it was, from what I remember, the second episode that I kind of dropped into that. So I remember things happening on Telos, but I don't remember any of the Earth-based stuff. Quite liked it. Like, six-year-old me thought it was brilliant, so quite like it. Probably younger than that, actually. I bet I was four, not six. Yeah, I'll have been four. So four-year-old me, quite liked it, stuck with it. And then I realised that my uncle had a load of videos. So I borrowed a few, and I think they were the Five Doctors, the Three Doctors, Revenge of the Cybermen, and Terror of the Zygons, and went home and binged them all. And then spent the next few weeks pestering my parents to take me back to my uncle so I could get more Doctor Who videos. So yes, UK Gold, even though I never actually had it at home growing up, was my way in. It was a repeat of Attack of the Cybermen, which is an interesting place to start, but it's a story that I do kind of hold in higher regard than some others, because I've just got that kind of nostalgia factor. It's a nice little story. Certainly an interesting starting point. But we'll move on, and we'll move on to Greg. Greg, how did you discover Doctor Who?
Well, I got into Doctor Who because of my dad, actually. I'm American, as you can tell from the accent, and Doctor Who was shown on our local in Chicago public television station, WTTW, on Sunday nights. And so even though I know in the UK they weren't getting reruns, this TV channel would run like every episode from Pertwee through to the latest one they had, and then just start over. So, I mean, I had access from a very young age to pretty much every episode of the show. But looking at the old schedules, I think it was 1987, so I was like 4 years old. And the Doctor Who was on at 11 p.m. on Sunday nights. And just by coincidence, like that year I was in kindergarten, and my kindergarten was from like noon until three or whatever. So my dad actually let, you know, 4 or 5 year old me stay up really late on Sunday because I didn't have to get up for school on Monday. And the first story I ever saw was Planet of Evil, and I barely remember it. But then following week was Pyramids of Mars, and it terrified the hell out of me. I loved that story. I still do. And that just hooked me into Doctor Who. And quickly my dad started recording everything that aired on VHS. So I had a huge pile of VHS tapes. And yeah, I mean, I didn't, you know, starting out, I mean, my first doctor was Tom Baker, but I mean, I'd seen most of Pertwee's episodes. They didn't have anything in black and white. And of course, back then, a lot of season 7 and 8 and 9 hadn't been restored to color yet. So I hadn't seen a lot of Pertwee, but I saw all of Tom Baker, all of Peter Davison, all of Colin Baker. And then like the first new doctor I got was McCoy. And so he kind of became my doctor. But yeah, I was very fortunate from a young age to be able to see pretty much all of color Doctor Who, when I know a lot of other people didn't have the same opportunity. But yeah, that started a lifelong addiction, which has cost me many hours and even more dollars, and I don't regret it at all.
And of course, now late at night is when you're going to be able to first see Doctor Who in the UK moving forward. So right. Maybe that 11:30 on a Sunday night, maybe that's its natural slot. Maybe that is where... Right. Doctor Who rightfully belongs.
Whereas I will now get it at 6 p.m. on a Thursday, so.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever. Fine. yes, I don't think I'll be one of the people that stays up until midnight for a new episode, but I probably will watch it first thing on the Saturday morning when I get up, assuming I've not got to dash out to do something mad or annoying or busy that definitely shouldn't be allowed on weekends. That leaves us with Gareth then. What's your origin story?
Okay, well, like you two, roughly, I was born during the 80s, so when I was kind of aware of anything, there wasn't any Doctor Who, which is kind of a paradox because there was so much Doctor Who. Like, it wasn't on TV, but it was everywhere else. So, you know, millions of books, which I'm still reading, videos, obviously, and then Big Finish and stuff. And also, it kind of permeated everything. So, like, there were references to it in random TV shows. Like, I remember there were jokes in The Vicar of Dibley, and there was stuff like Crime Traveller that just sort of felt like Doctor Who and things like that. So it was interesting being a kid then, because I don't exactly remember when I discovered Doctor Who. Like, I can't pinpoint a time when I didn't know it was around, because it just felt like sort of osmosis. Like, lots of things were kind of affected by it, and people sort of mentioned it. But I do have a specific date of the first thing I remember. I have the Second Doctor Handbook in front of me to confirm this, because there is a book about literally everything about Doctor Who. I can confirm the first thing I remember is a repeat of The Mind Robber, which was the last episode, and that was the 28th of February 1992, which was apparently a Tuesday. Yeah, so that I remember specifically, the bit where Jamie and Zoe are getting squashed by a giant book. And then the finale of that episode is just bonkers. I mean, it's just fictional characters suddenly appearing and having a big fight. So I really clearly remember that. And I remember that Doctor Who was on after Stingray. So I remember I reached a point, because there were more repeats after that. There was the Sea Devils, which was the big one for me. Absolutely terrifying. My dad was in the Navy, and he had this. He would take us to this army range. Army range, you know what I mean? Navy range. It was just called the range. And it was somewhere on the coast. I don't know where. But it very much, looking at the actual coastline while we were in this kind of military base thing, it really reminded me of the Sea Devils. And I remember being at an age where I was convinced I could see them, which was not great. You could see these kind of lumps coming out of the sea, and in my head it was just, oh well, I'm dead, there they are. Those repeats really had a huge impact on me. And also the whole Stingray thing as well. Stingray ends with this kind of slightly silly song about Marina, and I developed a kind of Pavlovian fear reflex. Like, I'd hear that and I would know that the next thing that was going to happen was going to be an episode of that scary thing, which obviously, you know, like everybody else, you're terrified, but you're still sat there. Yeah, and I remember it just became part of my consciousness after that. And I remember slowly becoming aware that there were videos that you could dive into. I think the first thing I did after seeing these repeats was I got a couple of the yearbooks, which were kind of spin-offs from the Doctor Who annuals, and they had all the pictures in them of all the different Doctors. And I remember just being kind of confused, but, you know, interested that there was so much ground to cover. And John Pertwee became the one that I was sort of the most attached to, because, like, his story was probably the first one I saw in full. And, yeah, I remember I started getting the videos. The first one I ever got, for some reason, it was Snake Dance with Peter Davison. I remember just my mind being blown by that 80s theme tune and just thinking, I didn't know they could change it. I didn't know it got, you know, there were different versions. Yeah, and from then, just I fell into the same delightful bottomless pit as the rest of us, where, yeah, as has been alluded to, if you have any disposable income, Doctor Who is a very good way to permanently rid yourself of that. But yeah, And here we are.
I think the amazing thing in terms of sort of Doctor Who being a leech on your bank account is it's always found wonderful, new, innovative ways of draining your bank account. It's, you know, the books, have they suddenly become a bit more affordable? Well, we've got audios now. And, you know, the audios, are they manageable? Well, here's a new series and a ridiculous amount of merch to go with it and books. And once those die down a bit, well, there's even more audio. The output has quadrupled.
Now imagine having to have those books and audios shipped to you from overseas.
And it's just amazing how there are always new things to throw money at. And that seems to be something that's absolutely the same all around the world, I think. But that's a great story about the Sea Devils and that kind of thing. It's a great story. It is kind of one of those, you know, whenever you go to a beach, you sort of half expect to see a sea devil, don't you? Mm. That's one of the great things about them as a creation.
What I found interesting about that story, Gareth, is that you both kind of talk about how there's this, you know, cultural osmosis of Doctor Who in the UK, because I mean, even though it wasn't actively on TV, everyone knew what it was and so forth. Whereas here, I mean, now of course with the modern show, people in the US know what Doctor Who is, but back in the 80s, I mean, it was this bizarre, obscure thing that aired late at night. Like, it wasn't, you know, if you go to school, you know, kids would get, you know, picked on for being into Star Trek or whatever, but, you know, not me, because no one even knew what Doctor Who was, so I couldn't even talk to anybody about it. It was just like my own private little thing that I enjoyed. And yeah.
I've got to say, even though from my perspective, and that's a really good point, that it's not the same everywhere. Like for me in Britain, it very much felt like everyone knew what Doctor Who was. It still became quite an embarrassing thing because it wasn't on anymore. And I think, you know, people like Russell T. Davies are kind of the first to point out there was kind of this stigma of like failure on it. So, you know, it's the TV show that got a bit crap and then they got rid of it. And I remember by the time I got to university, which was about 2003, I was almost weaning off it a bit. You can see where this is going. And I had a friend at uni, and we used to kind of watch movies with each other all the time. And we would watch Doctor Who, and we would actually use code. Like, I would feel so embarrassed about it that I would say, we're going to go and watch the British Institution, because I didn't want to say it was Doctor Who. Because I thought people would be like, God, you're into that. And so it was this really weird. And also, I went to university at very, very near Cardiff. And before you ask, I saw absolutely nothing, not a thing. Very embarrassing all round. But yeah, so I was this close to kind of weaning off of Doctor Who a bit. And then the bloody thing is everywhere again. And it was like, well, everyone else is watching, so I guess I'll dive back in. But I feel like I almost escaped, but nah, which is fine. It's good. I'm glad I still watch it.
I was in college, you know, when Doctor Who came back, when it was announced that it came back. And I mean, I'm like turning cartwheels, you know, in my dorm practically. And people are like, what are you so excited about? And I'm like, Doctor Who's coming back. And they're like, what now? So, again, just unable to share this with anyone. But fortunately, people got into the revived show, and now I actually fit in. So,
see, I was probably a little bit too young to have that. I mean, I was definitely, before it came back, I was the only person my age I knew that had even heard of the thing, let alone seen it. But I do remember when it did come back, when the new series started, it was over in Easter holidays. So actually, by the time I was back in school, there'd been three episodes. Like, we'd had Rose, The End of the World, and The Unquiet Dead. And I remember going back into school that first day after Easter, a little bit smug, because everyone was turning around like, that Doctor Who thing you keep talking about, it's actually really good now I've watched it. I'm like, yep, don't watch the old stuff, but yep, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, if you recommend it, they're immediately going to go and watch Timelash. Just first choice.
Yeah, if you want to see just how good it can get, go and find The Twin Dilemma.
Oh, this one's got H.G. Wells in it. It has to be good.
Oh, dear. Oh, no. Yeah, no, that's just cruel, isn't it? You know, I've discovered Doctor Who. I've seen three episodes, which are Rose to the Unquiet Dead. Where should I go next? Oh, Timelash.
I did actually have a slightly similar experience to that, where obviously once the show was back and it was huge, there was a feeling of I should introduce this to my friends, because like this finally isn't a thing to be embarrassed about. And we watched Rise of the Cybermen, and it's not like it's the world's worst thing ever. I can recognise now that it's fun. But at the time, within the first kind of 2 minutes, you've got this incredible panto scene of Roger Lloyd Pack doing his "How will you do that from beyond the grave?" kind of nonsense. And I could feel like I've lost them. Like, this was my first go and I've lost them. And just, I don't think they stayed for the whole episode. It was just, oh, God. Yeah, just sometimes, like, pick your battles. Yeah.
That scene specifically, I think, if you enjoy that, if you find it entertaining, then you are on Doctor Who's wavelength.
Yeah. I think there's a, you know, it's a wider conversation, but, like, there's a panic of people thinking it's ridiculous and being like, no, this is terrible, I'm going to dismiss this. So, you know, it's very uneasy. It's like how the burping bin in the first episode, like, it's right there so that you'll rip the plaster off and go, it's okay, we know it's silly. But at the same time, some people got really mad about it, so they were like, no, don't make it look silly or it will go away. So I think I had that crisis with that episode of the Cybermen, but hey ho, their loss.
19 years of looking silly later, we're still going.
It was never silly again, fortunately. It was dreadfully serious stuff, so.
Yes, that very, very serious Spice Girls sequence in The Giggle comes to mind, or indeed an episode called The Giggle. Well, that has been absolutely brilliant to share with you both, and indeed everyone that was on earlier. That's it. Spodcast has reached 100 episodes. We've done 100 of these things, which is just fantastic. And we're going to keep going for one more week, and then we're going to have a little break after that. We're going to go off air for a few months and sort of come up with ideas for new episodes, bank a few so they're recorded and ready to go, and generally just kind of try and cling on to the last bits of our sanity that have been slowly diminished over the last 100 weeks worth of podcasting. But a big, big, big thank you to absolutely everybody who's ever listened to us, contributed, told us how rubbish we are on Twitter, all of that kind of thing. You're all brilliant. So thank you very, very much. So we'll be back next week with the final episode of our second series. And then, like I say, we're going to have a little bit of a break. But series three is happening. We are coming back later in the year. And we're probably going to have to talk about the new series when that comes out in just over a month. It's not long now. So there will be plenty more podcasting in the future. But in the meantime, I'll say goodbye. Because they're the last ones here, I'll say goodbye to Greg.
Goodbye, and congratulations to everybody on 100 episodes.
It's brilliant. Like we're in the 100 club. There can't be that many Doctor Who podcasts that hit 100. So I'm glad we've reached it. And goodbye to Gareth as well.
So off for now. See you at 200.
And of course, thank you and goodbye to everybody who has been with me earlier in this episode. And like I say, we'll be back for more podcasting very soon. Goodbye now.
See ya.